John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Bukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, June 17th, 2010. Turkey declares that it will not send a new ambassador to Israel, and Gaza Freedom Flotilla 2 to launch in mid-July. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Turkey's government has decided to not send a new formal representative to Israel, is freezing a military contract, and ending joint military exercises for the time being. All this comes in response to the killings on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla this past May. Turkey has since become a leader among the nations of the world, expressing outrage and taking actions to punish Israel for its lawless act. In addition, Turkey has also suspended security cooperation and agreements to train pilots with the Israelis. This also comes with word that should Israel fail to cooperate with an internationally recognized investigation of its actions, that even more diplomatic actions are slated to take effect. No detail was given about what those further actions might be. 8 of the 9 dead in the flotilla were Turkish citizens. The 9th was a dual citizen of Turkey and America. This change in relations comes in stark contrast with what they were before the Gaza War and the most recent killings. Total economic trade between the two countries is in the billions of dollars, and until recently, military cooperation was very close. Details about the next Freedom Flotilla are also coming out. Mazen Kahil of the European Campaign Against the Siege says that all of the plans have been arranged and that this second fleet will be bigger than the first. The goods and ships are all ready to go, and by mid-July, Freedom Flotilla 2 should be on their way to Gaza. Kahil also indicated that many lawsuits against Israel around the world are in the works, and some are looking into bringing charges against Israel at the International Criminal Court. Israel's security cabinet met Thursday morning and approved easing the siege on Gaza. The naval blockade is still in effect, and the import of cement by anyone other than the UN is still banned. The security cabinet decided to expand the list of allowed goods into Gaza to include all foodstuffs, toys, and other household-related items. In the West Bank, Palestine News Network is reporting that 11 more residents were kidnapped in morning invasions by the Israeli military. 39 is the new total of civilians that have been taken by Israel just this week alone. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For constant update, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Brian Ennis.
Afghanistan yesterday. NATO is reporting the deaths of two occupation soldiers in an IED strike in an undisclosed location in northern Afghanistan on Wednesday, June 16th. Afghanistan yesterday. NATO is reporting the death of an occupation soldier in an IED attack somewhere in southern Afghanistan on Wednesday, the 16th of June. News reports are that this is an American soldier. Afghanistan, Tuesday. Two British soldiers were killed in separate small arms fire attacks in Nod Adli District, Helmand Province, Afghanistan on Tuesday, the 15th of February. Afghanistan, Tuesday. NATO is reporting another death of an occupation soldier from a, quote, insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan on Tuesday, the 15th of February. This is reported to be a Polish soldier. Afghanistan, yesterday. A roadside bomb struck a vehicle of a private security company, in other words, a truckload of mercenaries, in Afghanistan's southern Ghazni province on Wednesday, killing three, according to police. All three mercenaries killed were reported to be Afghans. Afghanistan, today. Hundreds of Islamist militants attacked a checkpoint along the Afghan border, and nearly three dozen Pakistani paramilitary troops are missing, security officials reported today. They do not even know if this is the Taliban or another group. Pakistan, Tuesday. A NATO oil tanker, presumably a tanker truck, was destroyed in a blast in Chaman, a town in the southwest Pakistani province of Balochistan near the border with Afghanistan on Tuesday, official sources reported. The Washington Post is reporting that U.S. military commanders fear they are, quote, running out of time in Marja, Afghanistan. We hear less and less about that Kandahar offensive that never seems to materialize and now is being put off until September, and instead we hear more and more about offensive after offensive by the Taliban. Iraq's been no piece of cake either. Iraq, Monday. Multinational Force Iraq, meaning the U.S. military, is reporting the death of a U.S. Division North soldier from the result of a non-combat related wound in an undisclosed location in northern Iraq on Monday, the 14th of June. Is this another GI suicide? Baghdad, Iraq, today. A roadside bomb targeting the vehicle of an education ministry official wounded three civilians in Baghdad's central Karada district, according to police. Mosul, Iraq, yesterday. A suicide bomber rammed his explosive-laden car into a police patrol while moving in the Al-Muthana neighborhood in northern Mosul, wounding 14 people, a local police source told China's Xinhua News Agency. Mr. Barack Obama, the Afghan war is now the longest war in U.S. history, with the Iraq war not far behind. Now is the time to throw in the towel and bring all the troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. You won't see me back there again. No, you won't see me back there again.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Well, DNA, it's natural. It's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life. Each one dependent on another, and so the circle it closed up tight. But then along came a man and a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, He made lots of strange, unnatural things, and now food crops grow on the ocean floor. Cows, they grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
On the 16th of June, animal rights protesters showed up at 701 Pennsylvania Avenue, home of three customers of puppy-killing Huntington Life Sciences, Novartis, AstraZeneca, and yes, Bayer. One of the activists, who happens to be Jewish, called out Bayer for their role during World War II as part of the notorious IG Farben, maker of Zyklon B.
That's not the half of it. Now we found out that Bayer is still in this building next to Mr. Ronald F. Rockstein, who is the VP of Government Relations. We also know you invented heroin and trademarked it up until World War I. Then you became part of IG Farben and made Zyklon B, and with a driving force behind the Auschwitz concentration camp. You dealt with Dr. Mendelin and Fritz Kabir, who's involved in playing a center against the Auschwitz. He was also heavily involved with the Nazis. He was arrested as part of the Nuremberg trial and served 7 years in jail. And guess what happened to him, Bayer? He was put on as the head of Bayer AG after his involvement with the Nazis and after his imprisonment. And here's what he had to say. They were prisoners, thus no particular harm was inflicted, and they would have been killed anyway. A scholarship foundation exists today in his honor. Bayer has sold many, many products that have gone on to kill people, such as Baycol, which has killed 31 people in the U.S., 52 people worldwide, and over 1,000 have been crippled as a result of your drug, Bayer.
Security seemed awful interested in videotaping protesters after this stuff about Bayer's Nazi connections.
Polluting the air, polluting the water,
off the animal slaughter.
You heard that, Bayer? So long as you do business with Huntington Life Sciences, people are going to talk about your past. Because in D.C. there's no sleep for the wicked. On the 17th of June, corner cutting, oil spewing BP CEO Tony Hayward found he could not escape the wrath of the people. As he prepared for his interrogation at a congressional hearing, a protester shouted him down. Yeah, Tony, I'll bet you do want to fly away, but you belong in prison after what you've done. The Gulf of Mexico. Is Con Air good enough for you? There was also a disgusting note in the hearing when right-wing Republican nutjob Joe Bart had the nerve to call a $20 billion pittance BP is offering after meeting with the president, quote, a shakedown.
Amounts to a shakedown. So I apologize.
Mr. Joe Barton, how about you apologize for 20 years of drill baby drill that helped make BP's spill possible? Better yet, how about you and Tony Hayward both go down to the Gulf of Mexico with a spoon and start eating those tar balls? You two book the plane, I'll bring the spoons.
The news service ProPublica reports British Petroleum was warned repeatedly about their record of poor safety and environmental noncompliance in internal audits throughout the last decade. These warnings came in advance of several serious accidents in BP facilities in the U.S. BP's confidential reports showed the company ignored a rash of safety problems in Alaska, Texas, and California. According to these reports, BP management ignored warnings about aging infrastructure and pressured or harassed workers not to report safety problems and to cut short inspections to reduce production costs. An internal 2001 BP report on its Alaska operations noted the oil giant had neglected key equipment required for an emergency shutdown, including a safety cutoff valve and fire detectors. Similar equipment failed in the fire and explosion on the Deepwater Horizon rig in the Gulf of Mexico. In 2005, an emergency warning system failed before BP's Texas City oil refinery exploded into a ball of fire, after which an internal review found safety issues at all of BP's five refineries in the U.S. In 2009, the company was fined $87 million by OSHA for failing to upgrade safety compliance procedures at the Texas City plant. Former Environmental Protection Agency lawyer Jean Pascal, who investigated BP, asked, "At what point are we going to say we are not going to do business with BP anymore? None of the other supermajors have an environmental criminal record like they do."
On the 12th of June, protesters showed up outside the BP gas station at 14th and Euclid Streets Northwest in Washington, D.C. on an international day of protest against British Petroleum.
Washington, D.C. says arrest BP! Washington, D.C. says arrest BP!
Here it goes. Protesters put new logos on the BP gas pumps that took BP's ridiculous and hypocritical green logo and added a black skull and crossbones in the middle, symbolic of all the death being sown in the Gulf of Mexico by BP's spill.
So we're putting this up because we want everyone to know that the oil disaster that's unfolding right now in the Gulf, and which is going to spread all up the eastern seaboard and including here to right up the Potomac into D.C., is BP's fault. And BP should pay not only for the reparations to the 11 people who died in that initial disaster, but for all of the environmental damage, all
and
of it.
And there's another thing people should know is that this symbolizes what this product really is. It's not green like this logo up here, okay? It's not this beautiful, wholesome, sunful green earth look. Green, the color of life. No, it is this. It is death. This is the destruction of the planet. We can't forget about global warming as a result of this product. People have to stop using.
All gas stations. You drive?
You sell oil. I don't drive. I ride my bicycle.
You have AC.
A number of people tried to counter the protest at this BP gas station by pointing out that gas stations such as this one are locally owned and make pennies on the gallon. However, for BP to exist as a corporation, their gas has to be sold. Their gas is sold through BP stations. And even though the wholesaling of oil and gas products are fungible goods, in the end, for every gallon of gasoline bought at a BP station like this one, somewhere, a gallon of BP gas has to be pumped back into the system by BP. If BP shuts down, this station could get another franchise. When people stop burning gasoline, perhaps this station will provide whatever is used in the place of gasoline. But we don't want anybody providing something in the place of BP's oil spills.
On the eve of President Obama's first address to the nation from the Oval Office on the continuing Gulf of Mexico oil spill, estimates for how much oil is gushing into the water from British Petroleum's blown-out well now range from 35,000 to 60,000 barrels a day, more than 7 to 12 times earlier estimates of 5,000 barrels daily. Representative Edward J. Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, contended that BP's lowballing of the amount of oil flowing into the Gulf was either deliberate deception or gross incompetence. Responding to criticism of his handling of the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history, President Obama has toured the Gulf Coast several times over recent weeks and named Michael Bromwich, a former Justice Department official, to clean up the government's Minerals Management Service, the agency that's under fire for its lax supervision of the nation's offshore oil drilling. But many environmental groups assert that it will take more than reorganizing government agencies to prevent future deadly oil spill disasters and coal mining accidents, but rather requires a national commitment to building a sustainable energy future. In a new report from Greenpeace and the European Renewable Energy Council titled Energy Revolution, A Sustainable USA Energy Outlook, the groups provide a comprehensive blueprint that they say will reduce carbon emissions while achieving economic growth by replacing fossil fuels with renewable energy and energy efficiency. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gabriel Wisniewski, Greenpeace climate campaigner, who discusses the Gulf oil disaster and the opportunity to reinvent the nation's broken energy infrastructure.
You know, we have to look at this from a couple of different angles, and obviously the first one is, what is our direct response to the disaster that's happened and is still happening, and how can we protect the ecosystem and the communities along the Gulf the most and the quickest? But then we also, I think, need to back up and realize that, you know, this time it was BP, but really the Minerals Management Service, which is a part of the Department of Interior, as you mentioned, has a very close relationship with the oil industry, and has for a long time. And it's that lax oversight that in part led to the disaster that we're seeing in the Gulf. But frankly, this sort of disaster is what we can expect if we continue to rely on fossil fuels like oil and coal indefinitely. Frankly, there's no way to do these things safely, and there's no way to do these things cleanly. So the only way to avoid accidents like this permanently is to quickly get ourselves off of oil and quickly get ourselves off of coal and embrace renewable energy like wind and solar that doesn't carry these sorts of risks.
Gabriel, describe for our listeners the importance of the Greenpeace report, Energy Revolution Evolution, a Sustainable USA Energy Outlook. What does that document tell us?
The Energy Revolution is a report that Greenpeace released with the European Renewable Energy Council. It's both a global report, and then there's a close look at the United States' role in it. And basically, it begins with the premise that we need to do what scientists tell us is required to prevent runaway climate change, with the understanding that if climate change goes unchecked, as it will if we don't act really boldly, the impacts will be hard to imagine. Economically, we're talking about major percentages of global GDP being spent on the adaptation and sort of late-stage mitigation of climate change, and then the human and environmental costs of climate change, just massive in terms of floods and droughts and food shortages and water shortages, rising seas. It really boggles the imagination to think of what could happen if we don't do anything. So this report starts with the assumption that we need to do to follow the science on climate change. And it looks at what technologies exist and what policies exist and have been tested in the real world to promote renewable energy. And it basically lays out a path, a roadmap, talking about how you can phase out fossil fuels like coal and oil and quickly ramp up both renewable energy like wind and solar and geothermal, but also how to squeeze every last drop out of the energy you're producing. We waste so much energy in this country and in the world that if we closed the window, so to speak, we could account for a lot of the projected growth in our energy demand. So it's basically a blueprint for how do we get from where we are now, dependent on fossil fuels, cleaning up an oily mess in the Gulf and mourning coal miners and here and looking at a future of unchecked climate change. How do we get from there to renewable, sustainable energy economy?
Gabriel, very often, particularly in news coverage of this British Petroleum oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, you hear pundits talking about the necessity to keep on drilling because this country is addicted to oil, and there's really no new technology or no new approach by government or industry that's going to replace oil in the near or long-term future. And that is the message that goes out to the American people over and over again, that there really is no hope to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels anytime soon. What message does this report from Greenpeace give us that contradicts that kind of doom and gloom scenario that we're going to be with oil and oil's going to be with us for a long, long time to come?
Yeah, that, you know, you just put your finger on it. That's a very, frankly, a very expensive lie that's put out there by the industry, and unfortunately is just sort of taken at face value and parroted by a lot of politicians and by a lot of people in the media that we can't, that we have to have fossil fuels, and that we simply have to deal with the sorts of things that we're dealing with now in the Gulf. And this report really pushes back on that lie and calls out the idea that, you know, if you take the bold steps in the short term to invest money in renewables and in efficiency, not only can you get off fossil fuels, but you can create a lot of jobs and save a lot of money in the meantime.
That was Gabriel Wisniewski, Greenpeace climate campaigner. Contact Greenpeace USA at 1-800-326-0959 or visit their website at greenpeace.org, where you can download a copy of the group's Energy Revolution plan.
Upon his return to Peru, indigenous leader Alberto Pizango was arrested and soon released, only to face a criminal trial. His return from exile occurred nearly a year after a bloody conflict between police and protesters last June that left 34 people dead. Pizango, head of Peru's largest indigenous federation, AIDSTEP, faces charges of sedition, rebellion, and incitement to violence. The charges result from the bloody events in the northern city of Bagua, where activists resisted attempts by President Alan Garcia to open the Amazon to oil exploitation. Pizango returned to Lima, Peru, to proclaim his innocence. According to Amnesty International, the federation leader was in Lima on June 5th last year, the day of the confrontation in Bagua. 24 police officers and 10 civilians died in the incident. It was Peru's deadliest civil conflict since its military launched an offensive against the Maoist Shining Path guerrillas in the late 1980s. Several weeks before the confrontation, Pizango called for Peru's government to annul a series of land laws passed without the informed consent of indigenous peoples. On his return to Lima, Pizango expressed his regret for the loss of life at the Bagua blockades and his wish for a spirit of reconciliation among all Peruvians. Latino residents of Arizona are starting to flee in anticipation of the state's tough new immigration law taking effect. According to USA Today, schools in Arizona's Latino neighborhoods are reporting sharp enrollment declines. Local ethnic businesses serving Hispanic residents are also struggling. The new immigration law, along with the impact of the severe recession since 2008, has hit the Latino population, both legal and undocumented, especially hard. Arizona's new immigration law requires police officers to ask about a person's immigrant status during routine traffic stops if there is any suspicion they may be in the U.S. illegally. In addition, the law makes it a state crime to be in the U.S. illegally, or to disrupt traffic to hire day laborers, whether the worker's status is illegal or not. David Gutierrez, a professor at the University of California, San Diego, told the Christian Science Monitor, "The economy is always the primary factor in determining migration flows. It might appear that the law is turning back the demographic tide in Arizona, but economic factors are a much more important aspect." The population exodus comes as Arizona has also been hard hit by a growing tourism and convention boycott triggered by its new draconian immigration law.
Your name?
My name is Linda Leakes.
Your organization?
I work with Empower DC.
Linda Leakes, a little earlier we were at Park Southern. You were passing out flyers to people. The flyers read, "Maturing mortgage could put your HUD housing at risk. Did you know you could lose your HUD housing? Urgent meeting. Join HUD tenants from other cities. It's coming up Thursday, June 17th. Talk about this upcoming meeting.
Okay, thank you. The problem is that there are a number of properties, HUD subsidized properties with mortgages that would be maturing in the next 24 months, and residents who live in those properties don't have any protection. And so we want to try to pull people together and so that we can figure out some kind of protection for tenants who live in those HUD maturing mortgages properties.
usually maturing, that sounds like a good thing. What's the problem with the mortgage maturing?
Yeah, it's a good thing for the owners because it means that they have been paying on their mortgages for 30 years or 40 years and they're almost done paying for it. Now, the problem is tenants who are living in those properties don't have any protection. So the owner once the owner pay off the mortgage, they are not under any HUD regulation, so they can raise the rents to wherever the market will bear. And if residents who live in those properties, they are typically moderate income people, and if they cannot afford to pay market rate rent, then they're going to be forced out. So that's the problem that we are having. We are coming together, tenants from all over the country, because that's a major issue that we are facing at this minute with these maturing mortgages. And so tenants from all over the country are coming together to try to find out, talk about, and decide on what it is we can do, what we can get Congress to do. Because right now, if an owner is prepaying the mortgage, that is, if they have gotten permission from HUD to pay off the mortgage early before it matures, then tenants who live in those properties have some protection. They will, number one, they will get a notice, or a 12-month notice that the owner is going to prepay, and then they will get a subsidy, a voucher, a housing voucher from HUD to help them pay the increased rents. But that's not the case with tenants who are living in these properties where the mortgage will be paid off.
You were speaking with tenants at Park Southern, which is at 800 Southern Avenue, and passing out flyers and letting folks know. Was anyone aware that the mortgage will mature and they could be in jeopardy of losing their affordable housing?
No, I didn't run into any tenants who were aware that they were at risk in any kind of way. In fact, there were some tenants who did reject me because they apparently didn't believe that this is about to happen. But there were some residents who were whose eyes did light up, and they did say they would come to this meeting. But they had not a clue that the owner could be paying off the mortgage.
Linda Leakes, I haven't seen this written about anywhere. So how important is it, this empowerment circle that you're doing Thursday evening, and that we start getting the word out about this issue, which is really, I think, completely off the radar?
Yeah, I think it's very critical, because in D.C., in other parts of the country, we're looking at 2014, when there would be a massive kind of maturing of mortgages. And so we're trying to get a jump on this issue and get Congress to pass some legislation to protect tenants in these properties, just as we had to, our tenants had to organize around the country to get Congress to pass legislation to protect tenants in prepaid mortgages, give them some protection. And so we're trying to just get a jump, because we see that we're looking at, in D.C., we're looking at several thousand household that are at risk, and around the country is close to a million units of housing that is at risk.
We're not talking at Park Southern. We drove from there and are now sitting at this below the steps of the U.S. Capitol. Why did you said this would be a good spot to talk? What's the significance of Congress in all this?
Well, Congress is the one who has to pass some tenant protection laws. Right now, like I said, tenants don't even have to get a notice. The owner is not even required to give tenants a notice that the mortgage will be paid off, which is different from prepaid mortgages. In prepaid mortgages, properties, the owner has to give the tenants at least uh, a, year's notice and has to give the jurisdiction, the mayor, at least a year's notice that they're going to prepay the mortgage. But that's not the case with when the mortgage is up and the owner can just pay it off because it's matured. It's at the end. They don't owe any more money on the mortgage.
And so what is it? The owners got help with their mortgages 30 plus years ago, and in exchange they were to provide affordable housing, and that's all coming due in the next, in 2014, much of it.
Yeah, that's right. And the tenants who are about to fall through this crack are more the moderate income tenants, because there is something called a Section 8 contract that a lot of these properties that have the subsidized mortgages, and when I say subsidized mortgages, there are certain programs that these owners got back in the 60s and back in the 70s where HUD or the federal government subsidized the interest rate. So that brought down the payment, the cost of the paying back the money. And so in exchange, they made these properties available. And now when I say it is the more moderate income people who are falling through the crack, some of these properties also have a Section 8 contract for the lowest income people. There's the Section 8 contract in this property. And those tenants are protected in that they will get and enhance their voucher, their Section 8 voucher will be enhanced so that they can pay the raised rent, because we know the owner is going to raise the rents once he's from under HUD regulation. But if there is no Section 8 contract in the property, like at 800 Southern Avenue where we just left, according to HUD's paperwork, there is no Section 8 contract in that property. That means that the residents there who are paying moderate rents, or their incomes are moderate incomes, in that they make too much money to be covered by Section 8, but they don't make enough money to pay, you know, the market rate, then they're the ones who are going to fall through the cracks because there's nothing out there to help them.
And Park Southern is just, can you describe it? I mean, it's situated on a up high. You can have just beautiful views. Right. And it's, when you see these pieces of property, these subsidized housing, public housing on these great pieces of land with a nice breeze coming through, it's worrisome thinking about the future if people don't act.
Yeah, it's beautiful property. There's a pool, and it looks like it's well kept. And when I first saw it and saw that was the address and the view from that property, I just knew, without even talking with the owners or anything, I just knew. I just know that owner is not interested in maintaining the HUD rent standards, whereas I know they could get a very high rent from that property. You sit there, you just look all over the District of Columbia. You can see all the surrounding areas. You can see Maryland, and who knows, you might even can see more than that, but it's just a fantastic vista. It's a fantastic view. And I know the owner would want to get as much as the market will bear from that property.
We don't have a bad view here looking out the U.S. Capitol. You mentioned earlier as we were speaking that Congress is moving to get the federal government out of subsidized housing on all levels, from Section 8 housing to traditional public housing. Why are they doing that?
Well, you know, actually, for the last 16 years, since Mr. Clinton was in office, there's been a major push on the part of the people in a lot of the representatives in Congress to get the federal government out of subsidizing housing without making available the resources that people need to pay for housing. So there's been a major push to cut back on any subsidy, any kind of resources, any kind of help that the federal government is giving to low-income people. And so what we see now, even under this administration, the Obama administration, we see a push to privatize traditional public housing. And for me, that's a scandal. That's a moral scandal because there is no resources. There's nothing made available to help people have housing. We need housing. There's no effort to make sure that we have income, jobs that pay a housing wage. The housing wage for the District of Columbia is like $25 an hour. D.C. has the highest minimum wage in the country, and that's $8 an hour. And the people in Congress are pushing against even raising the federal minimum wage. So there's no way that on our own, and this is mostly before the recession, so we know it's compounded since we have this recession.
Linda Leakes, you're having an empowerment circle, and you can maybe describe what that is. Thursday evening at Luther Place Church at 6:30 p.m. at 1226 Vermont Avenue Northwest. Talk about what you're going to discuss there, as well as, you know, what is an empowerment circle?
Well, empowerment circle is Empower DC's effort to educate people who are directly impacted by certain issue, like, for example, this issue with maturing mortgages. So this is a community forum. We invite everybody to come out, and we especially invite people who live in HUD subsidized property to come out. And what people will do, get a chance to learn more about this danger, this risk that folks are facing, and to talk about what it is we can do, what it is they can do, what it is we can do to protect people and help folks hold on to their housing. There will be people from around the country in town this weekend and at this conference who will be on the panel who are facing the same issue in places all over the country, but from Boston to California will be here. And tenants themselves will be talking about what we need to do to protect ourselves. So we want D.C. residents and D.C. residents who are directly impacted, but also people who support D.C. residents having quality housing, having affordable housing, and making sure that we can get some protection from this disastrous tsunami that I call it that is about to happen in D.C. in the next 24 months. So we want people to come out this Thursday, 6:30 p.m. at Luther Place Church, which is, again, 1226 Vermont Avenue. And if people know, that's at Thomas Circle, and looks like Inn and Thomas Circle. So please come out.
Any final thoughts you want to share, Linda Leakes of Empower D.C.?
Thank you, Pete, for this opportunity. Let me say that. And thanks for going out to 800 Southern Avenue with me today. But in final thought is that we need for people, D.C. residents, to come out so that they can join up. They can hook up with other tenants facing the same issue and concern, and we can go over on Monday and talk to the people with the power to do something.